Welcome to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And I keep wanting to use the advertising to say what this program is about, but I'm not going to.
All right.
So our program is about beef. I'm sitting here with the butcher's daughter.
Yes, you are. And granddaughter.
Yep. So you being from a long line of butchers and being a big beef appreciator.
Indeed.
And, you know, we spend a lot of time on programs. We did beans recently. We've done some vegetarian cooking. We've done grains and soups and fish. And
it almost seems like we've been avoiding beef.
Well,
it's such a great thing.
From time to time, beef is just
fine. It's a fun thing to eat. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Well, we've been scared. We've been told we shouldn't eat it for so long, you know, or moderate what we've been eating. I mean, it is a huge part of the American diet, always has been. I suppose it will be for a long time to come. We love beef, and we produce some of the best beef in the world. So
I know that even
it makes sense that we like to eat it.
I know that even for me, I mean, I grew up eating a reasonable amount of it.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, I've sort of systematically worked it out of being very consistent in my diet, but still once every 10 days something.
Yeah, which is crazy. Once every 10 days. So when I was a kid, we ate beef almost every night for dinner.
So maybe you should take a moment and tell a little bit of the story of your family's history as butchers.
Okay, sure. Proudly. My family came over 5 generations ago from Frankfurt, Germany. And when they came to the Wolf part of my family, Wolf side of my family, W-O-L-F, came from Frankfurt to Hellam, Pennsylvania. And every generation until my father lived in Hellam. And my grandfather had butcher shop, and then my great-grandfather also had butcher shops. And my grandfather's butcher shop was in Stony Brook, and he and his brothers had the shop together and did, I'm sure, okay with it until shortly before World War II. I know that the reason my grandfather took it over from my great-grandfather is that my grandfather was actually killed by an automobile. He was walking, and so my grandpa took over, and there was a time where, I think during the Great Depression, that, obviously everyone was struggling, and I think they had a hard time. So my father grew up that way. The butcher shop was out back of their house. So my dad, when he was old enough to do anything, was helping. When he was old enough to walk, he was doing something, I'm sure. And by the time he was 5 or 6 years old, he was standing on a crate and stirring the scrapple being made. I've always loved hearing those stories from my father. My dad later, when he was 17, actually went into World War II and was stationed in Guam and was a tail gunner on a B-29. And something I didn't know until I was in my early 20s. My father never discussed that with his daughters. Just a way of life.
But your dad's career changed from the backyard butcher shop in a significant way, but still in beef, right?
My dad always sold beef, always worked with cattle farmers. And my dad went from being, when he came back from World War II, my grandfather passed away when he was in his mid-40s. My dad was offered the butcher shop and decided that wasn't the route he wanted to go. My dad was the oldest child. There were just 2 boys in the family. And so he started working in small grocery stores in their butcher departments and eventually became a regional guy over many stores, and then eventually went from there to working for Swift. And then from Swift was offered a VP position at Hardee's, which at the time, and their home office was in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, which is where I lived when I was a little girl. My dad was in charge of purchasing all their food product and ended up, traveling the world for that position. And, they bought meat from New Zealand and Australia. And eventually when we moved from North Carolina, when I was 8 or 9 years old, we moved to Northern Indiana. My dad left his position and was VP of Ponderosa, when both of those companies were huge companies, had thousands of stores, thousands of licensees and company stores. And that's what I grew up with. I mean, my dad continued to travel the world for his work, and also, little things like, inventing the sauce for one of the Hardee's hamburgers, how McDonald's used to have their special sauce, what my dad invented one for. I mean, it's just kind of crazy to think about.
I just always think of your dad's story as being just exactly the arc of what's, you know, over time in America, the explosion economically and the explosion in food. You know, how it went from being in the backyard to being a global business.
Yeah.
And it's not even multiple generations. It's just he grew up working in the one and went right into right into the other.
Well, and you think about in the 1960s, which is when my dad worked for Hardee's, I mean, that was, you know, McDonald's, all those chains, that's when they started. And they were huge companies. I mean, they employed a tremendous amount of people. They bought a tremendous amount of beef product and, you know, potatoes.
I think that they still do. I think.
Sure.
In our second segment, we have Eric Oosterwijk from Fells Point Meats, who's the butcher who's been a wholesaler for the last couple of decades. And we're going to ask him a number of questions about beef and what's changed in consumption and buying beef from different sources. So that's something that I'm excited to get into.
We've kind of grown up with Eric here in Baltimore when he was still in the market, and we were there on the corner of Broadway and Thames Street, and we started to grow and eventually opened our own business, and he moved from the market and opened his own shop. And you know, I feel like we've always been together sort of on the same page. And
he's been an important regional guy.
He's been a very important regional man.
So I was thinking about it before, just preparing for the program. So what beef have I actually had in the world to eat? And as I sort of cataloged through it, well, one, I'm not the youngest guy in the world. So I've been a few places. I realized I've had beef from a lot of sources. A couple of times on research trips in particular, whether it was beef from Argentina or beef from Uruguay, but also, which is distinctly its own self.
Sure.
And beef from different sources from around the U.S.
Even beef in France is different. I mean, I remember the first time
especially
I had...
the Charolais beef.
Oh, very different.
Is a particular type. Some of the beef from Ireland or Aberdeen beef in the U.K. I've had a chance to have that. Beef from Italy, the Chianina beef, the big white muscular cattle. That are there. And one that people don't often think of, that people are really prideful about there in Spain, in Galicia, the Gallego beef, beef, cattle and oxen, both. They cut chops from those guys, and they're remarkable. But we have a mutual friend who's a Spanish wine importer who his entire mission on one trip was to take us to eat all of Jay Miller and I
what
take
an
us
opportunity.
To eat, you know, all the best beef in Spain to
That's
prove
amazing.
That it was as good as anything in the world.
That's so awesome.
What he proved is that he could feed his beef 5 days in a row.
There you go.
So that's, you know, speaking from some perspective. And everything is certainly different. And we'll talk to Eric about what things are like compared to each other. One of the basic things that people are concerned about sourcing, for sure, and they're concerned about methodology with producers, for sure. And one of the most interesting things, I think, for me has been talking to guests recently about American beef, whether from Kansas, Missouri, but Midwestern beef that's well marbled from big cattle, 1,500-pound cattle, Angus and other breeds as well, and cattle that's raised pretty quickly, 15 months or so, versus the beef from South America, whether from Argentina or Uruguay, and that's cattle that only grows to 800 or 900 pounds, and it takes 2 years to get there, and they live a diet down there of all natural live grasses, and they wander. They're still, you know, still driven herds, and I find that the taste is remarkably different, and I want to make sure that we explore that. And the texture is very different, and I think that that's important to note. So, Cindy, beginning to chat about beef makes me a little hungry. So how about you? A memory of a best steak or a best piece of beef or a big favorite or beef memory?
I think, you know, when I was growing up, we ate a lot of ribeyes. And, you know, I'm sure that was one of my dad's favorite cuts of meat. I, you know, porterhouse was pretty expensive when I was a kid, so I don't think that the whole family was going to each get a porterhouse. And my mother wouldn't have occurred to her to, you know, break it down and cut each muscle into slices. So, you know, I think ribeyes and my father used to love to grill out. You know, he you know, they used to barbecue in pits in the ground when he was a kid and did a lot of open campfire cooking and cooking outside, period. So we would often have ribeye, and you know, we just ate very simply when I was a kid. I mean, it was, you know, maybe the, if we were having beef, it was probably mashed potatoes and always a green vegetable. But for me, as a you know, that's a personal sort of more childhood memory. But for me, as a chef, there's no question that my favorite piece of beef is a short rib. I love beef short ribs. It's an arduous process to braise. It's a labor of love a little bit, but oh my goodness, when you get one of those fatty, gorgeous pieces of beef short rib, and I buy 16-ounce pieces from Eric, and you know, they have some bone in, so that helps to, you know, keep the meat the way that it should be. It gives you a lot of flavor. It gives you viscosity in your sauce as it reduces down because you have some good marrow in those bones, and the texture of a braised beef short rib is unbelievable.
Now I'm going to hit super you up for tender, a little bit of advice on braising beef.
Okay.
When we get to the last segment,
Tony, do you have a specific memory of eating beef somewhere that you just really loved?
Well, as I mentioned a little bit, I've had a chance to eat beef in different places where I traveled. That trip to Galicia and having all the Gallego beef, probably the craziest one was going into this. There's a place outside of Lyon, or Leon, I should say, in the north of Spain, close to Galicia. But this guy had an entire trailer, refrigerated trailer, with sides of beef hanging in there, and went in and had us choose what chop you wanted, what chuletón.
Wow.
From, and he described the different ages of the beef and where the cattle came from. And I mean, it was pretty crazy. He would go in to all these different farms and buy cattle and would have them hang in there and cut your steak and then cook it on a wood fire and then serve it. There's a tunnel with essentially no ventilation. And at the opening of the tunnel, you came out smoked, I guess is what I'm headed towards. The beef was amazing. And I was having dinner with a bunch of winemakers, and we had wine that was great with
it.
Great. But you came out smoked. There was at least two showers to get the wood smoke out of your body. But the flavor was great. I think that might be the top of the list for me.
Having, you know, the opportunity to pick from something like that. It's extraordinary.
It was pretty crazy. I think this guy was pretty crazy. when we come back, we should have with us Eric Osterwijk from Fells Point Meats, who has a tremendous expertise. All of that and more on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we have, I'm excited to say, we have Eric Osterwijk from Fells Point Meats, and who's been a long associate of ours.
Ever since we came to Baltimore.
Whose meat business has grown as we've grown over the years. And Eric, good to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So the program is about beef. And we wanted to get your perspective on all kinds of things, the changes in the market, what is popular now versus 20 years ago, what has happened with pricing, what are the things that affect pricing, just as a starting point.
Well, I can start out with, if you want me to, just a little bit about the different breeds that we use. So on the beef, what we mostly find is Angus and Hereford. There's a Brahman, which is from south of the border. There's some influence there, too, in the U.S. Brahman and Angus is the Brangus, for instance. The Brahman and the Shorthorn, they call it Santa Gertrudis. And then there's another crossbreed, Brahman, Shorthorn, Hereford.
Wait a second. Did you say Brangus?
Brangus, yeah, that's exactly right. Not that you will find that on anybody's list, and I won't either, and you will not be able to go to a restaurant and find Brangus steaks.
I mean, you have to find us at least something Brangus so we can put that on the menu.
Yeah, well, maybe. But the Brahman is not exactly a cattle that I would use for consumption, just because it's not the greatest beef cattle out there. If you can buy Angus, why would you buy Brangus?
Okay, then never mind.
Yeah. So, you know, it's out there. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's my recommendation. Of course, there's Wagyu from Japan, and the WA, it's W-A-G-Y-U, and the WA stands for Japanese, and the GYU stands for cattle. So it's basically Japanese cattle. Very high in fat, good fat, intermuscular fat, extremely tender, very different. And these things are graded as high as 5, 6, 7 times American prime. Very expensive. And then in America, American Wagyu you can buy, and that's usually crossbred with Angus. 10 or 20% or so of the animal is then Angus. And they do that to make it a longer animal, if I understand right. I think that's what I was told. And it's easier to breed that way. There's still only so many Wagyu animals on this continent versus Japan. So these are a little bit of the different breeds that we deal with here, Tony and Cindy, in the U.S.
The Angus and the Hereford being the most typical that you see, that you deal with. What size and how long does it take to grow them to that size?
Well, the animals grow for about 18 to 24 months. I would think, and if they don't use steers, but they do use cows sometimes, they are part of beef production, and they end up being a little bit older, just because of the fact that they need to grow to a certain size, and about 1,300 pounds heavy, 1,500 pounds, and small, you know, could be 1,100-1,200 pounds, but that. Gets to be really tiny.
1,100 pounds, tiny.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah. It is. I mean, this is walking around. So by the time this gets processed, it's it's a lot lighter. A side of beef weighs about 300 pounds, and there are heavier ones out there too. We've seen in the last couple of years a lot of heavy cattle, just because when these animals are in the pipeline. But the market is not requiring that much animal, so the we're just not selling it. Then they keep walking around for a few more weeks, and they eat more, and they get heavier really faster, really a lot faster than what we want them to be. And then you end up with, for instance, whole tenderloins that weigh 8 pounds, which is
big.
I know Cindy. We try to pick them out for her 5.5 to 6, and sometimes we're having a hard time doing it.
Yeah.
And those are out of the prime Creekstone, and they're awesome, and they're all natural too. On top of that, but we do find, not so much necessarily on that brand, but on the commodity product, yes, we get plenty of boxes with 12 pieces in it, and they weigh 90 pounds. So you can only imagine that if one only weighs 6 in that box, then there's got to be another 3 of them that weigh 8, 8.5 pounds.
Yeah.
So the industry doesn't like it when they're that heavy. And when it comes to a ribeye and a strip, you would have to cut a 12-ounce New York strip steak, and it wouldn't be any thicker than a half or three-quarters of an inch. It doesn't really do anybody any good. So they're trying to process the animals a little bit smaller, and trying to keep that in balance is not easy.
You had mentioned that some are bigger because demand is uneven or demand is a little bit slower?
That's exactly right. So they walk around a little longer. So you're saying, okay, well, you know, right now the market is not giving me what I want. They're too cheap because there's an overproduction. I'll let them walk for another month, but you still have to feed them. So they grow a little bit more. And instead of a 1,300-pounder, you might now have 1,350 pounds. And I'm not exactly sure about those numbers, how many pounds they gain in a month. I'm not a cattle guy. I'm a meat guy. But it does have an effect on all the muscle. Right off the bat, so they like to stick to these numbers as close as they can, and generally what happens, grain finished at 1,300 pounds, 18 to 24 months, grass finished, they only run about 1,000 pounds because they're not eating that grain. You know, grain finished animals also are out in the fields, and they, what a lot of places do, they have them on grass fields and forage, and they eat everything that makes them happy and healthy. But they feed them also grains and corns on the side, so they're capable of eating it. It's available, let's put it that way. Grass, you know, and grass-based forage animals, that's all they have. And they have to walk around a lot longer to get to that weight. You know, that can be up to 3 years sometimes before they're processed. Yeah, and then they're still only 1,000 pounds. So when we see grass-fed being more expensive, that kind of tells you the reason why. You know, walking around for 3 years versus a year to year and a half, to 2 years, I mean.
It's a very different commitment for the farmer.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And more risks to anything to happen to the animal in 3 years versus 2 years, year and a half. And
sure.
Even though generally they're healthier because they're not being fed anything that they're not supposed to eat. But the American palate always goes towards the grain-fed animals. They like the fat in the beef and on the inside of the muscle and the tenderness of it. And grass-fed, it could be inconsistent. There are some grass-fed companies, though, in the U.S. that have really done an unbelievable job in growing certain grasses that are high in proteins and lower in iron, so you don't get that minerally taste. Some grass-fed animals, really, the first thing you taste is that mineral taste on the back of your tongue, and you know that's a turnoff to a lot of people because they don't know it, and you don't have that with grain-fed animals.
Seems like there are a bunch of cuts that you'll see on a menu these days that are not cuts that you would have seen 20 years ago. You want to talk about those?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 20 years ago, it was all about, you know, making a lot of hamburger and the cuts that, and even today, are still the most popular, are the, you know, the strip, the ribeye, and the tenderloin. They're always popular. The sirloin, when you go to grocery stores versus looking at restaurant menus, you'll find a lot more cuts, of course, in the grocery stores, the chuck roasts and the this and the that. But what we're talking about now is small muscles that they've been able to pull out, especially from the front end of the animal, the shoulders. I think everybody, just about everybody's heard of a flat iron steak, and that's a muscle under the shoulder blade that is very tender. But you have to do something to it. When you pull the whole muscle out, there's a big gristle and some fat on the top. You take all that off, and then it's a flat piece, about an inch and a half to 2 inches thick, going out into a point being about an inch thick, and there's a big silver skin in between, going right through the middle of it. You have to separate that, so you have to put some labor into it, and you end up with two. Anybody knows what a flank steak looks like. You end up with two pieces that are like a flank steak, just a bit smaller. And it is, you know, it is about the second most tender muscle in the animal. And you have to like it. It has a flavor. It has a good flavor because it comes from the shoulder. But there are some shoulder muscles that I prefer over the flat iron. I'm not thrilled with the flat iron, even though they're out there quite a bit. And not only in restaurants, but also in retail. You can find them now. Another great muscle, which I absolutely love, is the teres major. Small little muscle right above this flat iron, again from the shoulder, weighs about a pound by the time you clean it. Small diameter, round, going out pointy on both sides. You can make medallions out of it, grill them whole, and then slice them thin, let them rest, and grill and slice them on an angle. One of my favorites, actually. I love it. It's a piece of meat you actually need to chew, which I think you should. you know, you cannot cut it with your fork, but it is definitely worth it having some age on it, wet age, and that's, you know, wet age in the vacuum packed for at least 30 days, and that makes it more tender.
And you're listening to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. We're talking to Eric Oosterwyk from Fells Point Meats on WIPR. It's interesting, you mentioned the chew. I agree with you on that, just on a personal taste basis. That's something that I think, at least with our customers and users, has changed some over the years. There are more people that want that, but an awful lot of people, if it's not super tender, if it's that's why the filet mignon is a gold standard for a lot of people, Have you seen that change with the way it affects how your product flows?
I think so. And the fact that if you ask somebody, I went there for a steak. Well, how was the steak? Oh, it was so tender. But that's the only thing you hear. It's not about the flavor was so good. I had that piece of meat and it just ate really well. To me, that's the most important part. It doesn't even have to be. I know I still like to chew it because I love doing it. And if I don't have a good knife and a good fork, that's also important when you cut a piece of meat. But I don't have to sit there and actually cut it with a fork. To me, that's not the most necessary. But to a lot of people, it is. But however, just coming back from Europe, and I spent some time in Portugal, and I actually ate beef one night. And it was a great-tasting piece of meat. And I can't think of the Portuguese breed that it was. They told me what it was, and I can't remember.
I think it's the same breed that you see in Galicia in the northwest of Spain.
Could very well be.
I've had some of the same, and it does have really good flavor.
Yeah, great flavor. I can't say that it was butter tender, but it wasn't. But then again, for me, it doesn't have to be. If you cut it right, and of course that's easy to say even you're a butcher, when you cut it against the grain or, it's going to eat okay, but the flavor made up for it. So the expectations for a lot of people, I think, now are a little bit different because a lot more people go abroad and they eat some different types of beef, but people get used to it more. So as anything evolving in this country that is still so new to a lot of foods compared to 30 years ago, it's come so far. 30 years ago, it was hard to find a good piece of cheese. And now you can.
That's for sure.
And that's with a lot of things. Or a good piece of bread, and now you can. The flat iron that I said earlier, they never used to take them apart. And if you go to a grocery store, you can still find them. It's called chicken steak. They cut them in little slices right through the gristles. Back in my native country of Holland, it used to be a braising piece of meat because it had all that silver skin in it, and you had to braise it. You braised it in the in about 2 pounds of butter, brown them first, and then added some water to it, and however my mother did it, in a
That's
pot
awesome.
On top of the stove. It was delicious.
Yummy.
With the right seasoning, and then it became very tender also. So it's actually a dual-purpose piece of meat. You can eat it as a steak and grill it really fast, but then you can also braise it, and it comes out like butter, which you could not do with a tenderloin. It'd be a dry little, hump of something.
So let's maybe give listeners an idea of something that they don't know about that they should be looking for, or if there's a new clever cut, or if there's something they should be buying to braise, or something else to grill, or something you just think is underrated.
There are pieces, and there are still pieces out there that I think are not being used, and I think it's because of the labor that the meat industry has to put in it. There's a muscle on the inside of the knuckle, which we call back home the bullet. When you take it out and all the silver is removed, it's actually it typically tastes like round, which is a really nice piece of meat. When you look at it, it's about the size of an eye round, not just not as long, but it has a much finer texture. And again, this is out of the knuckle. And it's the inside round muscle that comes out of it. And that's divided up because it has a little silver in it also. That's going to be hard unless your butcher shop in a supermarket, I don't think you're going to be successful, but your butcher shop might know what that is. That might be worth trying. Another one is a Denver steak. That is the top of, if anybody looks at a chuck steak, there's this lean, big ring on the top of it, which is coarse. It's coarse meat, but if you slice it thin enough, and again, if it has age on it, which is very important for a good piece of meat, that can be grilled very fast. And again, it has a bit of a coarse texture to it, so it's not butter tender, but it's actually not tough at all. And then when you slice it, it has great flavor. It's right from the chuck roll. It's basically where the end of the ribeye stopped. This piece of meat keeps going. And it's called the Denver steak. The Japanese call it the zabutan. On the whack, you can buy them as a zabutan, and it's high in if you buy a prime or a high choice one. It's got plenty of marbling in it, plenty of good fat in it, and grilling that is a very, very good tasty piece of meat. A Denver cut, Denver steak. Again, go to your butcher shop and ask them, because in the supermarkets these things are still not out there, you really need to go to a good butcher and get these things. But those are a lot of fun to try, especially if you know how to work your grill and like to do something different.
Eric, you've referred to dry aging and wet aging. Can you just let everybody understand what the difference is?
Yeah, the aging to a piece of beef is extremely important. Everybody needs to understand there's no such thing as a good fresh piece of meat, beef, that is. Wet aging, and that's what I said earlier, is when you buy something in the vacuum, or you can get your butcher shop to vacuum it, or you're going to ask somebody when you buy, for instance, a whole tenderloin or a whole ribeye or a whole strip, what was the date on the box that it came out of? Because I like it to be 30 days old in the vacuum. And the vacuum-maintaining vacuum, meaning if you poke a hole in it, then you're going to have to use it up. But if it's vacuum and it remains vacuum, if your butcher tells you, well, that was 2 weeks old, the date on the box is 2 weeks back, then you can buy that. I'm not saying that you can't use it right away, but you should put it in the bottom of your fridge somewhere and leave it there for another 14 days at a minimum and just check it once in a while. 30 days on wet age is great for a ribeye and a strip, 30 to 45. Some of your shoulder meats I just talked about, 30 days. A tenderloin can get away with 3 weeks. And what the wet aging and what all aging does is it breaks down the muscle tissue, the enzymes in it break down the muscle tissue, and the beefy flavor really starts to happen. So aging a piece of meat is very important. I like to do the same with lamb. Not so much with veal, not so much with pork. We do a little dry aging of pork, but it's a minimum time. And dry aging is when it's taken out of a bag and it still has most of the bone in it in order to protect most of the meat. And it's in a cooler just sitting there on a shelf for 3 to 6 weeks and sometimes longer, 60 to 90 days. And it dries in. And what we end up doing is then take the bone out, trim some of the fat off. The ends are like jerky. So you cut that off and you end up with a small part of the muscle that you started with, and it's now dry aged, meaning also it lost 15 to 20% of its moisture, which makes it a steak that you really shouldn't eat any more cooked than rare, at most medium rare, because then it gets a little dry. But at the same time, a lot of people prefer that flavor, and it's a little bit of a nutty flavor if it's done right. Some dry aged rooms in restaurants, they introduce certain salts into the environment. I've seen even straw to get that flavor into the meat as it's dry aging for a week. So boxes of straw sitting around in this cooler. Great idea, as long as your health inspector doesn't mind. And it's really a great thing. And again, the same happens to that, just sitting there and aging, but the drying process gives it a little extra hump. And generally, that meat is 50% more expensive than your wet-aged meat. But again, personally, a wet-aged steak, and most people in the Baltimore area are used to wet-aged and not so much dry-aged. Even in D.C., when you go further north, New York, Chicago, a lot of dry-aged product. A lot of it has all been dry-aged. They have dry-aged boxes in the restaurants. So very different, again. But great stuff either great. Way. But make sure you ask your butcher aging at least 30 days and ask him what the date was on it. And if it's not vacuum packed, ask him if he can vacuum pack it and sit on it for a while.
There you go. Thank you so much, Eric. That's great information.
Yeah, thanks for all the time and all the info. Mm-hmm.
No problem. Yeah. No problem. Anytime.
We appreciate you coming on.
And thank you for everything you do for us, Eric. We love you.
Don't worry about it. I appreciate it. Great talking with you.
Thanks, Eric.
Thank you, sir.
All righty. Take care. Bye-bye.
When we come back on Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine, we have a chef's challenge that might involve meat. All of that and more on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, we promised a lesson on braising beef. Everyone, I think people have become familiar with grilling. Right?
I think they know how to grill.
They know how to grill. but braising is something that people don't particularly do at home.
Well, and it also requires a stock, so it
eventually,
is a bit of
eventually,
a commitment.
Summer will end eventually.
Yeah, right. Maybe someday.
And you're going to want to know how to braise beef for the wintertime.
Yes. So first thing you do is you sear the meat. So you want a large, heavy-bottomed stainless steel pan, pot, whatever. You can either sear stuff in a big sauté pan and transfer it to a big pot, but why would you do that? Because now you have to clean two pots. But it needs to have a short side on it, because if it has a tall side, it will steam rather than brown, and we don't want that. And the other thing with browning things is you cannot overload your pan. And the other thing I will tell you about the fun of searing a beef short rib is it splatters all over you, and you can easily get little burns all over your arms. Ask any cook that's braised 50 short ribs how much fun it is.
So wear an apron and long sleeves.
Yeah, I would suggest wearing a chef coat at home. Go buy one.
I'm sure many listeners have chef coats at home.
Well, you know what? They're a lot easier to wash than your nice shirt. But anyway, so a neutral oil in the bottom of the pan, a big pan, get it hot to the point of smoking. It needs to just start smoking. You remain on high heat. The best thing to do to keep from some of the splattering, obviously it's the moisture in the meat that splatters, so that's blood. So you want to pat them dry. At least that will help a little bit. It doesn't remove all the moisture from the food, because you wouldn't want to, but it does help a little bit. So hot pan, neutral oil, corn oil, canola oil, whatever, and sear the meat on both sides. So don't overcrowd the pan. You can certainly put, you know, them side by side, but don't overdo it. It's not 90% of the surface. I would say about 85% of the surface needs to be covered. And as they brown on one side, you can flip them over and brown them on the other side. And if you're doing them in batches because you're making so many, or you don't have a gigantic pot, then you know, put them onto a sheet pan or a cookie sheet or something, a dish, whatever, so they can sit there while you're going back into the pan. You may have to add more fat to the pan to sear the rest of them. But just keep an eye on it. If the pan is too dark, you're going to have to get a new pan out and start all over again. So you really want to pay attention. You don't want to burn them. You want to brown them. And dark brown is good, but watch your pan.
And you want to salt them pretty well before they go in that pan, right?
You know, I don't, but I know that people do, and so you can do it either way, but I don't. I worry because when I braise something, I do not want my braising liquid to become too salty. So I hesitate to tell you to salt them. You can if you want to, but take it easy. Don't overdo it, because as you reduce that sauce, you're going to obviously intensify the flavor of the sauce, the braising liquid, and it can easily become too salted. And then if you take a couple more out of the pan once they're nice and brown, but leave some in near the end of the process, just pop your mirepoix in there. So carrot, celery, onion, large dice. It's hard for me to tell you quantity. I would say 20% of the product that you're braising should be about 20% of that volume in mirepoix. That's the only way I can think to tell you. And I always do 50% onion, 25% celery, 25% carrot. So that's the ratio. It should be more onion than anything else. And you just throw that in the bottom of the pan. What's going to happen is as you sort of let that scrape around in the bottom and you move it around in the pan, it's going to help to bring some of the fond off the bottom of the pan, which is that wonderful brown stuff that's happening.
Well,
and that's
also known
all kinds
as meat goo.
Flavor. Yeah, it's all goodness down there. And, and then once that's sort of worked a little bit, then you want to deglaze the pan. You may want to add red wine. Braised short ribs can certainly stand up to red wine. They're super fatty, super rich in flavor, and the acid from the wine helps to make them the sauce excellent, helps to balance out the sauce, and also gives you a little bit of tenderizer, natural tenderizer in the acid in the wine. So then you, let's say, again, I'd say 10% red wine, 90% stock. So then you add your stock. You want to cover by a couple of inches the product. You don't want it just right at the top of the short ribs.
Meaning short ribs are in the pan, and that there is an inch or two of
liquid above it, yeah. And you can either choose to, what you want to do with that is you want to bring it up to a boil and immediately turn it down to a gentle, gentle simmer. So low heat, just a little bubble every now and then. You can put a lid on it and put it in your oven at a low temperature and let it braise gently that way if you need to use your stovetop. Or you can just continue to do it on the stovetop. I will admit that I never put a lid on mine. So, you know, as long as there's plenty of moisture, I'm not concerned about my stock evaporating, which to me is really the main reason why. You know, of course it does create some steam if you have the lid on it, but I like to watch my food while it's cooking, see what's going on with it.
And this is a couple of hour process.
Yeah, and I would add a little bay leaf, whole black peppercorns, and maybe a little bit of, you could put in a piece of rosemary, you could put in a little bit of dried thyme or a couple pieces of fresh thyme. If you want, you could add a tiny bit of tomato paste to that process, maybe a tablespoon or two tablespoons of tomato paste. You don't want too much, but all those things make a lot of sense in there, and then you just braise them until they're tender. They need to be pleasing. You know, you need to be able to think, oh gosh, yeah, that's absolutely falling apart. But you don't necessarily want it falling into pieces. You know, if you go too far, you're just going to overwork them, and they're going to lose most of their flavor, and it's going to be all about sauce.
Yeah, hanging off the bone instead of falling off the bone. Right,
and it's hard for me to say. I would say about an hour and a half, maybe almost 2 hours, but I think an hour and a half is a pretty good judge. But you know, everybody's stove is different, and I mean that's the thing about cooking. You know, you just keep testing it. You know, once you hit the probably hour and 15 mark, start paying close attention to how it's changed. And then I take them out, strain that sauce, and then reduce it down. And I do add a roux to it because there's just not quite enough gelatin, because that's a pretty intense sauce, and it's all. Honestly, to me, it's so pretty. You don't have to reduce it so much. So I would just add a light roux, which is butter and flour, 50% butter, 50% flour. You don't need a lot.
Learning to make roux, it's pretty easy to find a video online.
Right. And then
it's R-O-U-X if you're
and you always add a,
playing at home.
And you have to add a cold roux to a hot liquid. So since you're most likely going to be in a situation where your liquid is hot, you want your roux to have been made and a little bit refrigerated. It doesn't have to be rock hard, but you do want it to be cold, not hot.
Now, you ready for your next assignment?
Yeah. Yes.
All right. It's your chef's challenge.
Okay.
Just what you wanted.
Okay. Oh, that's so funny.
Merry Christmas.
So I had beef short ribs as your chef challenge, and then I changed it when Eric started talking. All right, so beef short ribs, that's funny. Sweet potatoes.
We were just talking about it, so that kind of, you get a shortcut right here.
Fresh celery, carrot. Oh, gosh, I love our local celery right now. It's so exciting. It's so good.
The season's so short.
It's so full of flavor. I make soup with it. Oh, my goodness. Beef short ribs, sweet potato, fresh celery, carrots, poblano peppers, fresh corn, cilantro, sweet peppers, green beans, cranberry beans, dairy, herb garden, mirepoix, radishes?
Yeah. I like radishes.
Something and greens. Turnips.
Okay. Turnips and
turnips
their greens.
And their greens.
I also like turnips and their greens.
All right, so obviously I'm braising the short ribs, and I don't really have to go into that because I just told you how to do that part. But
what I'll do
is braise it with the carrots and the fresh celery. And quite frankly, since you gave me those poblano peppers near the end of that cooking process, I'm going to add the poblanos because that's going to make a really unusual, delicious dish. I'm also going to add the cranberry beans at the end. So that's going to be my braised dish. At the sweet potato, I'll roast in the oven until they're tender, and I'm going to make sweet potato puree, which I love to add a little bit of brown sugar, butter, salt, and pepper, and a little bit of Gosling's Black Seal rum. So that will be my sweet potato dish. And then the corn, I'll roast on the cob, 350 degrees, 35 to 40 minutes. Cut it off the cob quite simply. I will saute that in butter. You gave me some cilantro. I'm going to just roughly chop some cilantro and add it to the corn right before I plate it. The sweet peppers, I'm not really sure what I'm going to do with. And the radishes, that's easy. Radishes and turnips for me, I like them raw. So the radish and the turnip will be a little something to eat, and while guests are coming in or I'm cooking or family is there, whatever the case is, and just eat that. And the sweet peppers, I guess, just slice them up and add them to that. Just have a little fun crudité, and that's it.
Okay.
Here's yours, Tony. It's a good thing. I changed it from short rib.
Good Lord, this is the long list. Football party. Okay, then.
So you're having a football party.
Yeah, why not? Iberico ham, Marcona almonds, Yukon gold potatoes, Serrano peppers, garlic, onion, herbs, spices, dairy, olive oil, dry-aged ribeye. Thank you for that. Apples, pears, spinach, baguette, apple cider chanterelles. Well, I'm going to want to grill that ribeye, that's for sure. And I'm going to want to roast those chanterelles in like a big heavy copper pan or a big heavy bottom pan for a while. Do I have any garlic in here? Yes. With a tiny little bit of garlic, once some water has come out of them. So you probably got, I don't know, 15 minutes to get some of the water out of those guys. And when they start to caramelize, put a little bit of garlic in the pan, get some of that scent in there. Herbs and spices. Yeah, a little fresh thyme is nice too. But what I want is that ribeye coming off the grill with those chanterelles with really intense flavor as the garnish. That's number one. Iberico ham and Marcona almonds are easy. That's what you're... I'm afraid you're going to be forced to have that when you're drinking beer, drinking wine during the football game. Serrano peppers. It'd be fun to fry those guys if you have a fryer. You could also make a salad with the spinach, the apples, and the serranos. And make a dressing with cilantro and chives. Just a quick vinaigrette. Oh, well, I was going to say there's apple cider here, so I can use that. The baguette I would grill off. So you have almost like toast stacked up with the slices of the ribeye and the chanterelles. I might even use butter, believe it or not.
Shocking.
To finish those chanterelles, which would be really nice on top of that ribeye.
Be delicious.
Yeah, I think so. You gave me potatoes, which I almost never cook, which is kind of weird. Quick smashed potatoes, I think, would be the thing where you boil them in salted water and chill them down and then heat them back up in, like on a plancha, a very heavy pan, mm-hmm. in a little bit of oil, and literally crush them with another pan so they're all squashed and they're bursting out of the skin. Seriously.
Well, sounds good.
And then you put it on the plate and then you dress it with plenty of good olive oil. That's a pretty fun one. I think that's everything except for the spinach.
Well, you made a salad with spinach.
Oh, never mind.
So, Tony, what would you drink with our two chef challenges?
With your braised short ribs, I mean, sweet potatoes are a little bit of a factor, and that runs a little bit sweet. That American Cabernet would be great, maybe from Washington State. There's some really good producers with a good quality-price ratio up that way. I would look there. With the ribeye... may sound odd to some people, but there's some Italian wines that I like very, very much with that. Almost any Sangiovese-based wine, especially Kent Clesco Reservas or Brunello di Montalcino. I like those an awful lot with ribeyes. Malbec is a great match, but it has to be for a less fatty beef.
Alrighty.
Well, that's all we have time for on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. If you want to download this program or any one of our other podcasts, please go to the WYPR website, wypr.org, and look at the Foreman Wolf page, and you can find this and other episodes. If you want to email us, it's foremanwolf@wypr.org with questions, comments. We try to respond to everything that we get. If you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf and on Instagram as Chef Wolf.
My Instagram is The Real Tony Foreman. Well, thanks for listening.
Happy Sunday.